Welcome back to the most fabulous podcast in the world, a world of vicarious madness. Thank you for listening, subscribing, liking, commenting, wherever you are. And today, returning to Paris, we've the grand dame of the French theater, Sarah Bernhardt.
Ugh, be still my heart.
Born in Paris in 1844, most likely, because we don't actually know for sure when she was born. It may have been 1841 or 1843. Her birth certificate was destroyed during the Paris Commune, so no one knows.
And I'm sure she was a woman of mystery who would not reveal things like her age.
Yes, if you read her memoirs, she is actually a highly unreliable narrator of her own life.
Nice.
But we do know that she is the illegitimate daughter of Judith Bernhardt, a Dutch Jewish courtesan, though not a great courtesan like the Grand Trois of several decades later.
Were there great courtesans at the time?
For instance, Cora Pearl, an Englishwoman who moved to France and stayed there, is very frequently mentioned.
Gotcha. So it wasn't like that was a phenomenon that hadn't started yet. There were the fancier ones and the less fancy ones. And it so happened that Sarah Bernhardt's mother was one of the less fancy ones.
Yes, her father may have been the son of a wealthy merchant from Le Havre, but we don't know, and neither did she.
Nice.
And it bugged her.
Yeah, that I can imagine. I mean, it was maybe a more liberal time in some ways than we have today. But at the same time, not knowing who your father was, still pretty big deal.
Yes, and the fact she liked to exaggerate her life and there are name changes here and there does not help. We also know that at the age of 15, her mother may have had illegitimate twins in Le Havre, and this would have been in 1843, but they died within a few days.
Oh no.
And then her mother had moved to Paris with one of her sisters, and that sister married a businessman, and another sister came along and also became a courtesan.
How many aunts did she have?
Quite a lot. She also had one uncle. Her mother would also have another daughter, Jeanne, in 1845, but she didn't much care for Sarah, and later on her other daughter, Regine.
So what was her childhood like? I mean, it sounds like there was a lot of moving around.
There was, to an extent. Her mother did settle in Paris. She hosted a minor salon and actually counted the emperor's doctor as a lover.
Wow.
Yes. But Sarah, by the age of 3, was in Brittany being cared for by a nurse who had known her uncle. And this is how she ends up learning Breton much better before learning French.
Oh, yeah, that sounds like an interesting life.
Yes, and her mother didn't see her often. She actually tells the story of she ends up falling into a fireplace while it was lit and gets fished out and thrown in a bucket of milk. And then relatives, including her mother, come and fawn over her. She ends up covered in butter to prevent scarring, which somehow worked. But who knows if it was true?
Interesting. Yeah, because she's the only source for this.
Yes.
Yeah, no. I mean, it does sound like in her childhood there was an issue of that she was not maybe as close to her mother as she would have liked to be. And it sounds like whether this happened or not, she wanted to have that familial attention.
Yes, she really did. What is known is that she was ill at one point. She would also be genetically predisposed to get tuberculosis. By 7, her mother actually realized that she should probably go to school. So she...
Wow.
Exactly. Sarah Bernhardt had not been in any schooling up to the age of 7.
Mm-hmm.
So she went to boarding school for 2 years, where an actress from the Comédie Française, the premier French theater of the time, would actually come and recite poetry to the students. Naturally, Sarah then wanted to become an actress. She may or may not have appeared in a school play there. Again, we're not sure. We do know that after this, she goes to a Catholic convent school for 6 years, where she was only good at art and geography and constantly got in trouble and nearly expelled thrice for her pranks.
Oh, nice. For her pranks, do we know what they were?
Unfortunately, we do not.
Ugh, lost to history.
We instead know that she collected all manner of creatures, including lizards. She very much loved animals.
Oh, that sounds sweet. Did she have any friends?
Here and there, but not very close. We also know that she may have converted while there.
That's fine. I like a nice Jewish girl, but she can do what she wants.
Apparently, it was to learn how to blend in with the upper class, which the whole conversion would have been a part of at this point.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, that, I think we talked about it in another episode, that historically Jews have gotten by a lot better by assimilating, and sometimes assimilating means no longer being Jews.
But as we will see, Sarah Bernhardt was very much always seen as Jewish. By now, she's about 15, and her mother wants to marry her off into the bourgeoisie, which is how she ends up having a governess.
Ooh.
However, instead of getting married, she ends up at the conservatory via audition to study acting.
So that's a different career path. How does her family feel about this?
Well, she tells a tale of how there was an entire family council for one troubled teenager, and her mother's lover, the Duke de Morny, is involved and suggests that she become an actress.
Oh, wow.
Again, we don't know how well the accuracy of this story is.
Right, no. So something happens. There's some tension and drama, but she ends up going to acting school.
Yes, and she graduates from there in July 1862. And the Duke de Morny, we do know, actually manages to get her hired at the Comédie Française, though she still lives at home because she doesn't make much money.
Mm-hmm. It's a common starving artist thing to do.
Now, it's also said that her mother may or may not have tried to sell her as a prostitute along with her sisters.
Interesting. Wouldn't that be a step down if the mother is a courtesan, to sell the daughters? Like, wouldn't she rather train them so that they can have that higher station and make their own money and give some of that to her?
Interesting you should say that, because we do know that later on Sarah Bernhardt does briefly become a courtesan.
Mm-hmm. Family business.
Yes. We also know that Sarah at this time has a lover, though. Whether or not she and her sisters ended up being sold by their mother into prostitution at times, we don't know.
Interesting. Oh, gotcha. But so it's not a permanent selling. It's not like she's like selling them to a brothel or something. It's more she's like individually hooking them up with clients.
Yes. We also know that Sarah at this time changes her last name from Bernard to Bernhardt for stage purposes.
What are the stage purposes?
It sounds better.
I guess in French.
We also know her debut comes 1 month after her graduation. So in August 1862, she is in Racine's Iphigenia, where she had stage fright, rushed her lines, and it really didn't go well.
Oh no!
And from there, things did not go smoothly. She pissed off an older actress by refusing to apologize for slapping the woman when that woman hit her younger sister at her party.
Oh dang.
So she left that theater, which got people's attention. She ended up at another theater almost immediately, appearing in rather forgettable plays and understudy roles. She may or may not have taken a trip to Spain at this point. We're not sure if that is made up, because at this point in time, her son Maurice is born.
Interesting. How does she deal with being a mother?
She loves her son. Family was very, very important to her, which is part of the reason why not knowing her father bugged her. And she would come up with stories about how her father's servant or attorney or something was involved in her life, and that her father had wanted her to go to the Catholic convent for schooling and that sort of thing.
Mm. So then was her son's father active in his life?
No.
Oh.
Her son's father is a Belgian prince, Charles Joseph Eugene Henry George Lamoral de Ligne.
That is a lot of names.
It's Belgian nobility.
Not noble enough, clearly, because he's not talking to his son.
No, he is not. At one point, she goes to him, and he actually says, "I know Mademoiselle Bernhardt, but I do not know her son."
Okay, dude. Does he make any attempt to get to know his son?
No.
Ever? Asshole. Okay, cool. So, That is really sad. Yeah, how does Bernhardt like work to make sure that her son is okay?
Well, at this point, she's out of work for 2 years. So this is the time when she becomes a courtesan.
Gotcha. What is that like for her after pursuing her dreams, and now she has to kind of drop out of that?
We don't know as much about this. We do know it's confirmed from the police records of the Second Empire. They kept records of prostitutes and also, to a lesser extent, courtesans.
Was she, like, hassled by them at all? Was that... How far did the policing of this go?
So, for instance, at different times, prostitutes in brothels specifically usually were practically confined to the brothel in that they pretty much needed a chaperone to be out in public life. They had to go through regular medical exams, that sort of thing. Courtesans, a lot of them would not end up on the police records and would have much more freedom. As I said, we don't know nearly as much about these 2 years of Sarah Bernhardt's life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and it sounds like maybe she doesn't want us to know about these 2 years.
I imagine she wouldn't. Yeah. What we do know is that she ends up at the Odéon, France's second official theater, in 1866, where she becomes a favorite of the students who show up by various things, including yelling at them over them blaming Dumas for a play being banned.
Oh, wow.
Dumas is a very famous writer at this point, though there is Alexandre Dumas père and Alexandre Dumas fils.
Yeah, so father is this the son. Father or the son?
This is the father.
Gotcha. Also, we should note, Dumas, famous in the English-speaking world as well as the French-speaking world, has black ancestry, is black. Black people can be historical and important to our cultures. We should get over it and not be so racist. Just a little side note.
Yes. So she's back to acting, but then it's 1870 and the Prussians have crossed the border. It's the Franco-Prussian War.
No, not that. What is the Franco-Prussian War? What is the scope of this?
The Franco-Prussian War, as its name suggests, is a war between France and the newly united Prussian state. And the whole point of it is to basically take the territories of Alsace and Lorraine from France.
Gotcha. Does it work?
Yes. Alsace and Lorraine are annexed into the Prussian Empire.
Mm-hmm.
However, before that, Sarah Bernhardt goes and takes the Odéon Theater and turns it into a hospital. She becomes a nurse and stays so long in the theater-turned-hospital that she would sleep on the floor.
Oh, wow.
And when the Odéon came into artillery crosshairs, she moved everything, so different people would go to different hospitals then. By this time, Paris is under siege. She has sent her family to Holland. They would actually move without her knowledge to a spa near Frankfurt.
Nice.
She was very upset about this when she found out.
Mm-hmm. Well, especially because she's staying there working her butt off. So does she have any, like, friends who are working with her here? Or any people, compatriots, people who she's working with to make this happen?
She has several friends who are other actors, but she's the only one really doing so much with the war effort. So the war ends. Alsace and Lorraine are annexed to Prussia. She then leaves to collect her family and then returns to find the Paris Commune in full swing.
Gotcha. And let's have a little discussion of the Paris Commune, because some people may not have heard of it. Some people may have heard of it but not know what's going on.
So the Paris Commune is a time right after the Franco-Prussian War, where the working class sealed off the capital and instituted a new government that didn't last.
What was this government? What did it look like? What was day-to-day life like there?
So during the 2 months that the Commune ruled Paris, they established policies including the remission of rent during the siege, abolition of child labor, the right of employees to take over an enterprise deserted by its owner, self-policing, that sort of thing. There was a whole lot of feminist, socialist, and anarchist undercurrents to the Commune.
Yeah, it sounds very idealist. Like, a lot of people who had really strong social criticisms saw an opportunity to actually put those in place. And I have heard anecdotally a lot of people, a lot of leftists looking back at this time and saying, oh, what could have been? How does Bernhardt fit into the Paris Commune? Does she participate in it? Does she skirt the sides of it? How does she engage?
She takes up residence outside of Paris. As we know it earlier, at this point, the buildings holding her birth certificate are burned down. And then the French army marches in May 1871 and puts an end to the Commune.
Mm-hmm. That dream that could have been.
So now the Commune is gone. France is entirely governed by one government again. And the Paris theaters reopen, so Bernhardt returns fully to Paris.
And what is Paris like now? It has been ravaged by war. It has been taken over by the Commune. Have things changed since when she was there last?
Yes, because we actually enter a new era, La Belle Époque, which will last until the start of World War I.
Aha, and what characterizes La Belle Époque?
La Belle Époque is an interesting time. There's a great flourishing of art, of wealth. There's also quite a lot of inequality. So it really depends what social class you're in for what experience of this era you have.
Right, so I imagine that the people of the Commune were not pleased that all of their ideas of reform and revolution and radical change kind of got abandoned.
Those ones who weren't dead, yes.
Right. Ugh. So Bernhardt in La Belle Époque, she has had some higher connections before. Does she manage to grab the wave of that kind of fancier upper class current?
Yes, she does. So she meets the writer Victor Hugo and actually works alongside him. She plays the role of the Queen of Spain in his Roublard. He was by this point 70 to her roughly 27.
Mm-hmm.
They had an affair and a pregnancy scare.
Okay, that's fine. Make your own choices, Sarah.
It was not her most odd choice of lover. We will come to that later.
I mean, it is Victor Hugo, so that's pretty cool, but still.
Yes, at this point, she actually also ends up back performing in the Comédie Française, which she would then quit again in 1880 to go do her own thing with renting theaters to put on performances. But from here, her fame just balloons in leaps and bounds. Not even the scandal of her son's birth years before could quell it in the disapproval of Victorian England, even.
Dang. So somewhere along the line, she went from stammering out her lines and messing things up and getting stage fright to becoming a really good actress.
Yes, grand dame of the French theater. She is one of the best actresses. People laud her voice, her acting, everything she puts forth into a performance.
Do we know how that happened or when? Or is it just years and years of continuous work at it?
So, as I said, her voice was considered good. She did study a lot. Also, her looks were unconventional, so that got her a bit of attention. Some would say her acting involved extreme emotion. She also used exaggerated gestures, especially abroad, as she only performed in French.
Mm. Wow. That is pretty impressive that even people who didn't quite understand what she was saying could understand what she was saying.
Yes, as one person described her performances, she put her heart, her soul, physical grace, and sexuality into a role. There was glamour and excitement to a Bernhardt performance.
Wow. I mean, and it does sound from her life so far like she had a lot of ups and downs to draw on.
Yes. An odd quirk of hers is she would actually study medical text to make her death scenes both effective and accurate.
Wow. That's impressive. It kind of reminds me of visual artists who, you know, like painters and other kind of like pastel artists who will look up medical texts to see, you know, how do muscles move around each other and all that type of stuff. There's a lot to learn from science when you're doing the arts.
Yes, she would actually dabble in other art mediums. She would take up sculpting, though she was not the best, and hang around other artists, including the lesbian painter Louisa Bema. A possible affair there, for instance, there was a letter with a painting of Bernhardt done by Bema that said it was painted on the anniversary of their love affair. Some have doubts on that letter.
Interesting. So this does bring something up. We know that Sarah Bernhardt liked men. What do we know about her attraction to women?
Practically nothing.
Love it. Would that have been something that she would have hidden? Because you have said that she was a very unreliable narrator and liked to really control how people saw her life.
I don't know. It may well be that rather than hiding it, she preferred more men than women. And considering she had tons and tons of male lovers, and newspapers would actually add in even more men than she actually slept with. So it may well be it was just an avalanche that buried everything.
Gotcha. Yeah. But there are enough rumors that we can probably say that she liked women. Is that fair to say?
Yes, because there is a great deal about Louisa Bemma and Bernhardt that's talked of. And as you know, when we went to see the play Bernhardt Hamlet, about her time performing Hamlet, they mentioned some woman called Francine.
Mm-hmm. Who was Francine? Did she exist?
I have not encountered a Francine. I would love to get my hands on the source material used in the writing of this play to find out who was Francine. But back to her life, which was also quite well documented in the press, including her stuffed bat hat and the time she slept in a coffin.
I love how all these historical ladies are just, like, kind of goth.
Well, as for the sleeping in a coffin, she actually did it once because she had given a sick person her bed to sleep in, and the maid came in before she woke up, thought she was dead, and screamed. So then she held publicity photos in the coffin.
I love it, using it to her advantage. Yeah, it really sounds like she likes to control the narrative around her life, but
she does. She may also have, on occasion, tried to get her lovers to have sex in the coffin.
All right. Just for funsies.
And then, of course, there's the time in 1878, during the Paris Universal Exposition, that she took a flight over Paris with the balloonist Pierre Giffard and the painter George Clarin. The stunts and the scandals do not end there. There's also the fact that newspapers erroneously reported that she was the unwed mother of four kids by four men, a hairdresser, a man who killed his father and was headed to the guillotine, Emperor Napoleon III, and Pope Pius IX.
Wow. Did she end up having any other children?
No, Maurice was an only child.
That is actually kind of impressive if most of her lovers were male, that she managed to figure out birth control well enough.
Well, as we noted earlier with her affair with Victor Hugo, there was a pregnancy scare.
70-year-old. Anyway.
Anyway, she then went on a tour of America where everyone expected to see a seductress and was confused to find a serious actress.
I know, it's always weird to these people when, like, actresses are not, like, sex workers. They're, in fact, people who are dedicated to their craft. Like, you don't see a painter and you're like, oh, that painter probably wants to have sex with everyone. Like, no. Come on, guys. Get it together.
Artists have standards.
Right. Also, like, to be clear, sex work is, like, work, and it takes a lot of effort and it takes a lot of skill. But it's a different type of work than acting. There's overlaps, but an actor is not trying to seduce everyone, generally speaking.
Yes. Then there's the fact that the Canadians of Montreal particularly disliked her. We're getting there. In fact, they attacked her at the railroad station and her hotel because of her Jewish heritage.
Love it. Love them anti-Semites in Canada.
And yet they then ignored the church telling them not to go see her performance on Christmas and went anyway.
Love a good hypocritical anti-Semite. My favorite kind.
Yes, of all the places she went, Montreal was the one that was consistently anti-Semitic, because on a subsequent tour, they included chants about killing her for being Jewish.
Love it, but still want to see her. I guess it's good with it. So historically, Christmas has been a time when Christians will go out and try to kill Jews in their areas. So I guess it's good that they were seeing her play rather than doing that.
Yes. Newspapers also caricatured her, but she had fun on this tour. She even attended a Philly female impersonator going by Sarah Hartburn.
Oh, that's wonderful.
The tour was not without other drama. There was the man with a whale who got her to stand on it and then followed her from city to city with the carcass in tow.
Okay, dude, interesting idea for a side act.
Yes. She was not amused.
No, I bet not. That sounds a bit creepy.
Yeah, there were also the discomforts of dirty hotels and rushing to different cities to perform, and the occasional bit of danger, like the time Sarah bribed a trained engineer to cross a bridge after torrential downpours, despite official warnings. The bridge collapsed moments after they crossed on the way to New Orleans.
That sounds very scary. Also, maybe don't do that.
But after 7 months, she returned to France, 2.6 million francs richer.
Is that a lot? I don't know what money is.
As no one on the internet seems able to convert 2.6 million francs in 1880 to dollars in 2020, we can just say it's about somewhere between $5 and $10 million thereabouts.
All right, so she did pretty well for herself.
Yes. Not long after that, though, she took a tour of Europe for 6 months in 1881 that included performances for the King of Spain, King of Italy, and Tsar Alexander III of Russia, who, when she bowed to him after performing, insisted, "No, it is we who must bow to you."
Wow. She was that good.
Yeah, he also gave her a pet hawk that she added to her collection of animals that included a lion cub.
Did she keep the lion cub when it grew up?
Yes.
Interesting. Did she have servants? Or someone to watch over all of her animals when she's going, to different countries?
Yes, she had servants.
Okay, good. I'm just thinking about the animals. That would have been a lot to maintain.
But again, anti-Semitism reared its head on her tour, this time with demonstrations in Kiev and Odessa, which also mixed with anti-French sentiment.
Interesting. Usually you don't see anti-French sentiment combined with anti-Semitism, considering how much anti-Semitism you find in France.
It seems they couldn't quite tell if they should hate her for being Jewish or hate her for being French.
Mm-hmm. I like that they acknowledged she was both, though. Some people don't do that.
But then she fell in love with the actor Jacques Demala, 10 years her junior, who was terrible at acting, but Sarah ignored that and had him perform alongside her.
Well, sometimes you have to have a himbo. It's fine.
She even married him, when before she had said she would never marry.
Yeah, because at the time, marriage was like kind of giving up your rights to the man, right?
Yes. For the longest time in the U.S., for instance, a woman who married a foreign man gave up her citizenship and took his.
Yeah, so this was a big deal. How did this work out for them?
They ended up having to marry in London at a Protestant church because southern France had issues with a Greek Orthodox man and a Jewish Roman Catholic woman getting married.
I mean, fair enough.
It turned out to be a hell of a mistake.
Oh no.
Demala, who not only couldn't act and harmed her own career by performing with her, spent her money like a drunken sailor at an Argentine brothel, gambled, womanized, was a bigot, and didn't love her.
That's so messed up. That really sucks.
It doesn't end there. He also hated being Monsieur Bernhardt. She was so famous, he might as well just be Monsieur Bernhardt.
No, he really had to take her name, right? Because he couldn't act, and, she could. If he wants anything out of this marriage, he should at least take her name.
It doesn't end there. He also publicly insults her, flaunts his mistress in her face, and developed a morphine addiction, which Sarah's sister Jeanne supplied him with, though her sister would die before he did.
Wow. Just messed up. This whole thing is so messed up.
Yes, I like to think that her sister was like, well, if she won't divorce him, I'll get rid of him myself.
God. Ugh, as I said before, very messed up.
Eventually, she threw him out and he left to fight in Africa with the colonial troops before coming back to embarrass her further.
No, it's still not over.
It's still not over. At one point, he tore her dress on stage, exposing her bare butt to the audience.
Wow. What a horrible husband. What a horrible guy. I'm so sorry for her that she, like, tied herself to this horrible guy.
And yet, she never divorced him.
Why?
We're not really sure, but she nursed him through to death by overdose in 1889, buried him in Greece, gave him a monument, and mourned him.
Even though he treated her like crap?
Yes. Others, of course, did miss him because they found him revolting, and supposedly Bram Stoker used this guy as part of the inspiration for Count Dracula.
Oh yeah, because he was sucking the life out of her?
That's actually very good. When I first read that sentence, I couldn't understand because it's been quite a while since I read Stoker's Count Dracula, but I don't recall Dracula being as repellent as this man.
Well, I mean, there's all of that romanticization of vampires between now and then that we have to contend with.
But as to why she never divorced him, as one biographer notes, it's a mystery why great women pick terrible men, and at the summit of their art as well, when they could have anyone.
Mm-hmm. Literally anyone, including me, with a time machine.
He actually, this biographer, makes reference to Bernhardt's Italian counterpart, Eleonora Dusa, and the gnome, Gabrielle D'Annunzio.
Yeah, the gnome. Why was he so successful? He looks like a gnome.
He also was not the best partner. This biographer goes on to speculate whether it has to do with terrible men actually knowing how to cause orgasms or not. The jury is out on this matter, and we have no idea when they'll be finished lunch. So, moving on, and speaking of Dusa, Bernhardt had a bit of a rivalry with the Italian actress. Though inspired by seeing Bernhardt perform in Turin as a child, Dusa did not get on with her. Their styles differed. The press, if they appeared in the same roles, would pit them against each other and ask things like, who was better, who slighted whom, who came out on top.
Right, it's that classic, there can't be two talented women in the room without them hating each other. No, they always have to be in competition, especially over a man. They can't possibly just admire each other's work.
Yes, we must have dueling divas.
Right, exactly.
This wasn't helped by later on, Bernhardt once asked when Dusa came up in conversation, whatever became of that old lady? It should be noted Dusa was 15 years younger than her.
Mm-hmm. Man, that's too bad.
But Bernhardt continues with her tours. She actually goes to South America, where she apparently was given 13,000 acres of land in Argentina, but she never knew where.
Yeah, and what would she do with it? She's a touring actress, not a farmer.
Have someone else have a ranch and run it for her? I don't really know.
I guess that's so weird, though.
What I do know is she then leases the Renaissance Theater in 1893 until 1898, where she performed when not on tour, which she frequently was. And then she met the writer Edmond Rostand in 1895, when he was 26 and she was about 50.
Interesting choice.
They may have had a brief affair, but she was also good friends with his wife.
Now, when you say good friends...
Not like that.
Okay, fair enough. It was more in the sense of, you know, everyone's friends here, so we're fine with people having affairs.
On occasion, yes. She would then go on to produce some of his plays, helping him into his career, though she would not star in his Cyrano de Bergerac, so he wrote L'Aiglon for her in 1900, where she played the doomed son of Napoleon Bonaparte. By then, she had done several trouser roles, as they were called, and was known for doing very well in them. For instance, she played Hamlet as Hamlet. You can actually see a clip of that on YouTube, and there is a modern play about this as well, which we noted.
Yes, which is really good. If you have a chance, go see it.
At the same time, the Dreyfus affair was making its way through France. A Jewish army officer was accused of selling secrets to Prussia. In reality, a Catholic officer did this, but many believed it was the Jewish one.
Right, because anti-Semitism, alive and well in France, has been for a while, still is today.
Sarah spoke in his defense. By this point, though, her son had married a Polish princess and had two daughters, which, though it thrilled her, her son took the opposite view on the Dreyfus affair. She raised him as a Catholic aristocrat, so he fully believed Dreyfus was guilty. He even went so far as to cease speaking to his mother over this.
See, normally when people talk about self-hating Jews, I'm like, that's BS. But, come on, dude. Like, why do you think your mother had to assimilate like that? It was because of the anti-Semitism.
So anyway, he then decamped to Monte Carlo and refused to have anything to do with her for a year. They eventually reconciled, but even in 1905, years later, it was an inflammatory subject still.
Wow, that is really too bad.
Then in 1902, she relented to playing in Germany and the annexed territories of Alsace and Lorraine. At the invitation of the French Ministry of Culture, she took part in the first cultural exchange between Germany and France since the 1870 war. She performed L'Aiglon 14 times in Germany, with the Kaiser attending twice.
Ooh, did this smooth over relations? Did it help things get a bit chiller around there?
A little bit. She also toured America again, where she performed L'Aiglon, at the same time as the American stage actress Maud Adams did, in the same city, though Bernhardt was in French and Adams was in English.
There was a problem for them?
This was not a problem because people flocked to see the both of them perform.
I love it. Turns out women doing things can actually be complementary to each other, and they don't always have to feud.
Yes, so complementary, in fact, there was at one point talk of them performing Romeo and Juliet together, with Bernhardt as Romeo and Adams as Juliet. Sadly, despite Adams agreeing even to learn French and perform it in French for Bernhardt, this was never done.
Ugh, the real tragedy.
Great plays that we could have seen, but never did.
Right. I mean, that we personally couldn't have seen in any case, but that the world could have seen.
Great tragedy there. She also appeared briefly in two film adaptations of plays she had been in, The Dame of Camellias and The Loves of Queen Elizabeth. She also wrote her memoirs in 1907, and at some point in this time she told the courtesan Leanne de Pougy, who came to her for acting lessons, to keep her mouth shut when on stage.
Because as we mentioned before, being a sex worker and being an actress have a lot of things in common, but are different, and take different skills, and sometimes you can be good at one and not the other.
And de Pougy was not good at acting.
Really too bad. Now, I do have a question about film. How was that for Bernhardt? Did she find it different from the stage? Did she take to it? What was it like?
She did not have the time to master film, and several people believe that her film performances, though we have footage of them, don't do her justice, as we went over her style before with the great deal of exaggerated gestures and whatnot. This sort of over-dramatic way of acting that did well on the stage doesn't quite translate to film. So I, for instance, would say that the film performances aren't the true Bernhardt performances.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. I mean, because it's like her on a soundstage in front of a camera versus her on a much larger stage in front of a live audience that she can play to and who's responding to her, and she's feeding off that live energy.
Yes. And then comes another interruption. It's 1914, and it's World War I. But it's also, by this time, getting the Legion of Honor and a leg injury that led to gangrene, so they cut it off not far below her hip.
So she's disabled now. What does she do with this? How does she survive?
She refuses the idea of an artificial leg, crutches, or a wheelchair. Instead, she is carried around in a litter she designed herself, and she continues to perform.
Wow. Does she only perform roles that call for disabled people without legs, or?
No, she doesn't. She comes up with clever ways to hide the fact she only has one leg.
Ooh, like what?
Sitting in certain ways and whatnot. I've seen photos where she's standing, but it's sort of like she has one hand on something so she doesn't fall over just from being on, say, one leg. I don't know if she mastered the art of just standing on one leg and not losing her balance. I do know she appeared in a patriotic film, French Mothers, in 1917, and that she also played Joan of Arc in another.
Dang. And she is not Joan of Arc's age at this point, so.
She had also we must note in her 50s, played a 20-year-old boy in L'Aiglon and did superbly well in it.
Mm-hmm. Right. So she is not constrained by the bounds of age or gender.
She is not. She also gave speeches at Red Cross rallies and spoke on issues involving women and racism, including praising suffragettes who stood with a black woman when a hotel refused to let her join them at their conference.
I love it. I love that solidarity. We are here for that.
After the war, she continued to act on stage and wrote a textbook on acting. Her family tried to persuade her to retire. She refused, in part because she was the one who really brought in the money.
Nice.
She also had uremia in 1917, which is a buildup of waste products in the blood that leads to kidney failure, and it now returned. So though she's scheduled to film in her own house, actually, a movie called The Fortune Teller, she couldn't finish the shots. She lingered for about 2 months with her family and Louisa Bema at her bedside. She then died in 1923, and a crowd of people outside her window had to be informed so by her doctor. For 3 days, people filed by her famous coffin,
wow,
which she now rested in for the last time. The city of Paris paid for her funeral, even.
I'm so glad for once we have one of these women where people actually care about them at the end of their life. They're not alone, and they're not abandoned by all the people that they loved. Thank goodness at least one of them saw the attention they deserved.
Speaking of attention they deserved, hundreds of thousands, maybe even 500,000, some say, people lined the streets as she was taken in this coffin to Père Lachaise Cemetery. Paris had not seen such a funeral since 40 years before, when Victor Hugo died.
Wow.
And today, there are so many biographies and references over the last century to her that just covers pages and pages. In 1960, even, Bernhardt was inducted into the Hollywood Walk of Fame for her roles in film and is the oldest person there. There's even a saying from parents to drag girls, "You're a regular Sarah Bernhardt." Imagine being so famous you inspire a saying. It's like how Google caused its name to be used for the phrase searching for something on the internet. We say we Google it now.
Yeah, yeah. No, and Sarah Bernhardt, similarly, a household name.
Yes, and naturally inspired many other actors. We saw that earlier with Eleanor Dusa. And of course, she's known as one of the greatest French actresses, if not one of the greatest actresses of all time. And remember, hot guys can ruin your career too, so don't marry him.